Good evening, Mrs. Marklich, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Aidan Dobkin, writer and journalist, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Aidan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you find out about this story?
This was a matter of total happenstance. In fact, I was writing a short story set right around the end of World War I, a subject that's really been near and dear to my heart for some period of time, specifically kind of looking at how culture and average people rebuild after the end of wars. You know, I had seen a lot of both nonfiction and fiction books address significant events through the light of what would happen shortly after they ended. But I really didn't see so many that talked about what are people left with at the end of a massive conflict. And I so happened in the course of research to come across the fact that the Tour de France passed through this small town that I had set my story in, and did some very preliminary research, just looked at where did stages start and end, who were the cyclists, and I realized a couple things. First, that most of the cyclists who started the 1919 Tour de France bike race didn't wind up finishing it.
Yeah.
And due to the fact that the Tour back then really tried to encompass the entire country, I saw that they wound up passing through the Western Front, which was just wild to me and something I had never expected just 7 months after the war ended. And so almost from that very first moment, I said, you know, I have got to set down the story. It's, you know, I still want to return to it someday, but I just need to take on this story. And I want to do it in a nonfiction book, because so much of, you know, I do think there is an inherent power to nonfiction and being able to tell someone like, hey, these guys really did this just 7 months after the war, just, you know, weeks after they had left uniform. You got to hear this story.
It is that kind of story. I have to admit, you know, I was skeptical going into it. It was gripping. And we're not going to give away who won. I'm just warning you right now, listeners. You did an amazing amount of research because you ended up getting to know individual cyclists. In this. How hard was it to do that kind of research?
It was not the easiest story I've ever written. I was fortunate enough to have access to the entire digitized archives of L'Auto, which was the newspaper sponsored the tour back then, as well as the French National Library's digital archives, which included those newspapers, also included a number of other papers surrounding the cyclists. And so, you know, it was not as though I was really digging through absolute scraps, but, you know, these are generations removed from our contemporary life. The, you know, we're talking about second and third generation individuals who, you know, the cyclists back then were, yes, athletes, yes, well-known, like, yes, part of the lingering history of the Tour de France bike race, but they're not to the same degree as we view athletes now, like titans, superstars, you know, and they're much more like average people. These are people who, you know, had left uniform just, you know, weeks before to race in this bike race. You know, at the end of every bike season, they would go back to being mechanics or, you know, whatever else they were in their day-to-day lives. And so, you know, I dug through military and government records to see, you know, where were they fighting. I, you know, spent a lot of time in the newspapers and just kind of looking at those scraps and pieces. So, you know, it wasn't the easiest thing. You know, there's no ability to really have, you know, interviews with these people. But, you know, through the gradual accumulation of materials, I kind of, And a very in-depth itinerary of the race itself, I was kind of able to at least get close to viewing the race through their eyes.
Okay, for people who don't know, and here in America, a lot of people don't follow Tour de France. Why don't you just sort of outline what Tour de France is?
So the Tour de France is a bike race. It was kind of the first and longest and most difficult of its kind. Not the first of its kind in a bike race, but the first that really sought to do day after day of stages, which are, you know, lengths between city to city, to really bring the entirety of France into its fold. Nowadays, for those of you who might follow the race or might not, it is a much different event than it was back then. Stages are shorter. It no longer seeks to encompass the entire border of the country over 15 to nowadays 22 or 23 stages. So this was a race that really is uniquely culturally and politically enmeshed with the history of modern France. It is an event that was started by a right-leaning newspaper to boost subscriptions. It is, you know, now since kind of transcended that, but still retains that interesting history that is bound up within ever since 1903 with the Dreyfus Affair.
Right.
Kind of traces the history of France in the, you know, particular conduct of its stages. And back then, the race was longer and grittier. And, you know, it's one of the things that I had to become accustomed to in the course of researching and writing this book is, and one of the reasons that I think I was first interested in this story is that it's not just a long kind of intense race, but it's much closer to an adventure or, you know, or an ultra marathon, although I think it transcends even that. And these are people who are riding through, you know, small towns that had just been devastated by the war. They're, you know, closely enmeshed with the people that they're passing by who offer them a few francs, you know, depending on who rides through their town first and whatnot. And so it is a race. It's the contemporary tour still bears many of its marks, but this is a cultural event and a political event and a historical event as much as it is a significant bike race.
The fact that it was held in 1919 blew my mind. As you mentioned, the war had just ended. I mean, there are military personnel all over different parts of the route. And I want to talk about Henri Desgrange and Lotteau. He's really the mastermind behind this 1919 race. Why did he want to do it so soon after the war ended?
He is one of the more fascinating characters in this book and is kind of, without positive or negative judgment, I think, you know, I kind of waffle between the two,
yeah,
depending on, you know, where I'm at in the story and how much research I've done on him and what sort of research I've done recently, but really a larger-than-life character. The race for him was what wound up being his legacy, more than being the editor of this newspaper, which was ostensibly his job when the tour started and remained his job through almost the very end of his life. He retired a few years before he died, which, you know, neatly actually corresponded to the start of World War II. But this was someone who was a PR person who was recruited by advertisers to start a competing sports newspaper that would ideally insert itself less into political affairs of France at the time, but had very little editorial experience and had even fewer editorial ideas about how to distinguish that paper, Lotteau, that he was recruited to lead. And so at some point in the first years of the 1900s, one of his correspondents comes up to him and says, you know, right now sports newspapers, they, you know, sponsor races all the time, you know, allow themselves exclusive coverage. What if we made a race that was longer than any other, that really transcended, you know, there were day-long races. There were multi-day races that were held inside tracks. But what if we really tried to create an event that spanned the country? And this was the first iterations of the Tour de France. And so I think by 1919, you know, the first few years, it was not clear that the race was going to succeed. Cheating was rampant. There were, you know, cyclists weren't fully confident that they really wanted to test themselves over these lengths.
Well, first of all, you're going through two mountain ranges too. You're going through the Pyrenees, right, and the Alps, and yes, and reading that section, if back in 1919, that was an amazing event just that they got through those areas.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people have to keep in mind that bikes back then.
I was going
to
ask you about that. The bikes weren't the modern bikes that we're familiar with at all. They're like iron bikes, right? They're made out of iron.
Yeah, like steel frames, you know, two gears. You have to flip around the wheel in order to change gears. You know, you're wearing, like, heavy wool jackets and whatnot. And you know, it, and that's why I say it requires a rethinking of what a sporting event looks like, because it was less about riding up the mountain at a quick pace, but just, you know, when were you going to get off your bike and walk alongside it just to, you know, boost your energy a tiny bit? So it was really just about survival as much as gaining that little inch over an opponent.
But 1919, I mean, the country is just getting over the war. So at these ends of these different stages, there are towns, and since the beginning, which was only a short time ago of the Tour de France, people expected to have places to stay and food and water. And that was true for some of the places, but some of the places just didn't have room. I mean, there were soldiers staying in hotels and stuff like that, and supplies were not always what they should have been in the race. That's one thing. The condition of the roads was another whole thing. You do a lot of description of what it was like to sort of pedal along these roads. The roads sound like a disaster.
Yeah, this is, you know, still in that first molten stage after the war ends. You know, people, the fighting is done, but even now there are still sections of France that, you know, you cannot totally traverse as a function of World War One. I mean, a lot of my research was spent walking the battlefields and kind of just trying to understand, you know, what it, would the scene have been like. And you know, 100+ years on, it's a little bit of a different experience, but you can still see the marks of what these cyclists would have been passing by or riding over, which would have been so much more devastated at the moment. You know, the roads that they traversed were, because of the nature of the race, which did not just seek to go from the largest city to the largest city, it was a key part of the Tour de France was riding through these small towns and really, you know, connecting those people with the event of the race. And that meant that you were going to be taking supply lines instead of roads that would have been, you know, trampled as a function of the machines that they were never really designed to carry, but had to during the war. And, you know, and then cobblestones that had not been maintained in years and stuff like that. And it's sometimes hard to fully grapple with just how much devastation they had to cross. And totally unassisted. That was another function of the race.
Oh, right. You could not help another rider out. If you were a rider and you helped another rider out just by giving them some water in a case in the book, you were penalized.
Exactly. And what's more than that, if you were a cyclist and your bike was in one way or another, I'm not going to say destroyed, but damaged, it was on you to repair it and use that same frame. You could only use one frame in the 1919
That's right.
Race. You started with one and
ended one bicycle, the front fork just split And he had to find a way to sort of solder it together.
Right. And so being a successful cyclist in this race was, yes, you have to be a good athlete, a different sort of athlete than maybe the ones we're accustomed to today. But you also have to be self-sufficient and capable and interested in carrying yourself across these distances and confronting whatever sort of problem you might have faced along the way.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Aidan Dobkin. And we're talking about his new book. It is a gripping read, Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. How is a winner judged at this point in time? Is it just the first person who comes across the finish line?
Yeah, so there are various iterations of tour scoring in those first years when Henri de Grange and the other journalists of Lotto are trying to figure out what is the best way to create this gripping event over the course of a month. In the 1919 race, it was simply a function of time, as opposed to points or anything like that. There was a general classification that was split between professionals and amateurs. And essentially, whoever made it back to Paris at the end of the month, within the shortest amount of time, granted there were penalties and stuff like that, but was the winner of the general classification. So at the end of every day, they would sign back into the logbook, their time would be recorded, and if you, over the course of 15 stages, made it back to Paris in the shortest amount of time, you were the winner of the general classification.
Now, I want to talk about flats, because that's a constant theme throughout your book. These poor bikers, bicyclists, rather, I should say, they're having flats, like, constantly. How are flats even repaired back then?
Yeah, so as is the case in every sort of repair in this race, it is a much more drawn-out, arduous affair. It is a matter of, you know, for the most secure connection, you would kind of cement your bike tire into your frame with, like, a rubber sort of cement. So you would rip off the tire, rip off the tube. You know, typically, if you look at pictures of the cyclists at this time, they would, like, backpack straps would have uninflated tires kind of strapped across their shoulders, and you would, put back with a little bit of tape instead of cement just for ease, put back the uninflated tube, inflate it, put the tire back on, and then hope that it's going to last you for some, you know, extended distance over the course of the stage, although, of course, that was often not the case, and sometimes there are stories of cyclists who, you know, repair one tire or tube rather, only to have their other one bust, you know, just a short while longer. And this is just a constant theme of the race as a function of the road conditions and the distances they were riding. And it just became part of the rhythm of the race. It was, you know, it was an inconvenience, but at least if you were a cyclist, you could comfort yourself with the notion that, you know, in all likelihood, most cyclists are going to encounter one of these along today's stage, the next stage after that. And it's really just hoping that it doesn't happen at a particularly unlucky time when you're trying to sprint to the finish line or something like that.
Now, the dropout rate, and you mentioned that before, was amazing. By the end of the race, there was only a fraction of the people that started the race that made it to the final stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the race starts with 67 people, which was a diminished number from the preceding year, and winds up with 11. And this is a function of a lot of things. I mean, there was a generation, really, of cyclists who didn't have the opportunity to train. I mean, I think I mentioned this a little bit ago, but these were people who, yes, the war was over, but the occupation of Germany was, you know, in its full force. there was rebuilding that was sometimes assisted by the military. And so, you know, in the run-up to the start of the race, I was reading Lotto's pages as a kind of, because they really did try and emphasize every portion of the race, since they were just trying to get subscribers and they had exclusive access to the race at this time. So they were just giving their readers every update that they could imagine. And they talk about, as cyclists start to register for the race and, you know, getting out of uniform and just barely making the starting line. I mean, all things considered, you know, just weeks in advance. And, you know, I aligned those with their military records. And these were, you know, folks that were really not fighting the war, but dealing with the aftermath of the war in uniform up until the weeks before that they started the race.
So they haven't even trained. They haven't even trained for a lot of them.
Right. You know, there were a couple who managed to compete in one or two races in the course of the war, just shorter distances. But, you know, this is such a unique event that competing and really being able to just spend constant time on the bike is a really key way to be competitive in this race, in these distances that are just so long. I mean, every stage is oftentimes just as long, if not longer, than many of the one-day events that they would have been competing in at the time. And so they were, you know, just thrust into this event, and an event that was as intense as it had ever been. You know, Henri de Grange didn't say, well, it's just 7 months after the end of the war, we still want to do a Tour de France, but maybe let's go easy on them. No, this was, you know, the second longest tour in history. And with people who, you know, had not had time to train or had not had time to really, like, grow into themselves as professional cyclists. You know, some had died in the war, some were injured. And then this kind of hodgepodge of cyclists, of ones who remained, were thrust into this incredibly intense event.
And the weather did not always cooperate during this event, needless to say. And there was one rider, I don't know why I picked up on this, but it just struck me as, oh my God, could it be any worse? He comes down with hemorrhoids. And the whole thought of that, of going through this brutal race over these bumpy roads in these old style bicycles with hemorrhoids, just really struck me as, oh my God, give up.
Yeah, it is. It just goes back to that idea of cyclists who are just able to survive, and just surviving the race puts you in a good position to potentially win it, or at least, you know, be really competitive in it. So it was so much about straining oneself. I mean, there's another cyclist who, you know, gets the equivalent of trench foot because of day after day of just, like, in tiny leather shoes in the wet rain, you know, climbing up mountains, which I just thought was a really great parallel to the fact that, you know, he would have gotten out of uniform just a month ago. You know, for those who are familiar with World War One, soldiers just standing in, you know, shin-high water for weeks and months. And I just, yeah, it was just such a evocative and gross image for me to consider, just the fact that, yes, like, in addition to the insane intensity of the race, these cyclists also just had to deal with kind of various injuries that really didn't, you know, in an ideal bike race, those things shouldn't have to be the thing that differentiates a winner from a loser. But in this particular type of race, in this vision that Henri de Grange came up with, those were just as important as whether you could sprint a little bit quicker than someone else.
You have several chapters which are digressions, which are either people or sometimes groups of people that are in they sort of drive through the area and you follow along. And so this ends up being sort of a sort of skeleton history of World War One too. I think it was just south of Grenoble, there's this whole thing about poison gas. And when they get to the area of Alsace-Lorraine, that was one of the most contested areas. That had long been a contested area between Germany and France. And these bicyclists just go right through it.
Yeah. I wanted the story to be one of rebuilding or delayed rebuilding as much as it was about a bike race. You know, I am interested. I follow the Tour de France, but what really drove me to this event, as I mentioned, was a story of that first kind of molten moment after a war ends, and people are really trying to figure out what to do with their lives. And World War One has always been interesting to me, just based on the various cultural movements that arise in its aftermath. And I view the cyclists as kind of delaying this rebuilding in their individual lives as they're witnessing the devastation of the war. But I did want to tell the story of how this kind of still amorphous new world was being built in the aftermath of World War One. And, you know, the best way I knew how to do it, and the way I really wanted to from the beginning, was following those who would have been watching the race and who, you know, the cyclists are not the most diverse group of folks, you know, in the world.
But they were all, in almost every town, there were people lining the roads. They knew they were coming. We're out of time right now, and we've only barely scratched talking about this book. This is a fantastic book, and it, like, you really get to know the cyclists.
Thanks so much.
My guest tonight has been writer and journalist Aidan Dobkin, and we've been talking about Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Aidan, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.